From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
And then we finish the week with our after party on the Friday for all of the featured designers and major press and whatnot from the week.
So I think it's a waste of time to be sitting down thinking about yourself. If people stop thinking about themselves and go out and did something, they'd be better off.
When people of Japanese origin move to a Western world, their obesity rates will increase.
Coming up on this fiery Friday edition of Playback Daily, Ireland Fashion Week is happening. Get your glad rags ready. Eyes wide shut, Enele Launa has no time for meditation. And what can we learn from Japan's low obesity rates? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that is eating sushi for the rest of time. And off we go into the unknown of the Oliver Callan monologue. And this morning our host has decided that the glass slabs in our pockets are all too often in our hands.
She can't put down the phones at this stage. What's going on? And it's a habit that drives parents up the and employers up the wall. The Irish Daily Mail tells us this morning, Generation Z can't seem to stop checking their phone, even when they're supposed to be having a conversation. They've done research. Experts have gone out and said that it takes just 2 minutes and 15 seconds for Gen Z. So they're in their late teens, early 20s. The generation thing has broken down weirdly. 2 minutes, 15 seconds before they reach for their phones during a conversation. So they're chatting away to somebody and average 2 minutes and they're picking up the phone. 18 to 28 year olds. There you go. That's where they're up to. I mean, it's kind of across generations there. Experts say the constant need to look at their phones is a manifestation of the anxiety and isolation felt by those in their late teens and early 20s. Well, there's never been more of those young people in the world. What are they lonely about? They're lonely because they're on their phones, and they're on their phones because it's very profitable for a handful of companies. No, don't go to the dark side this morning. It's Friday crack only.
Friday crack, eh? Let's see how long that lasts. Because next up is, well, the effect of weight loss drugs on other companies. Not much hilarity to be had there, surely.
Skinny jabs, as they call them, things like Ozempic and Wegovy, which is made by the same people. I think it's a stronger version of Ozempic. Ozempic is for diabetes, by the way. It's the only way it's prescribed here. But privately in America, people are getting their doctors to give it to them because it suppresses the appetite and so on. So Weight Watchers, one of the world's biggest companies in the dieting industry, is preparing to file for bankruptcy because of the rise of drugs targeted at people who are dieting. New York headquartered company, it's been around since 1963, would you believe? It helps users monitor their diets by attributing scores to different foods. It also sells a range of ready-made meals and low-calorie wines right across the world. Well, it is preparing to begin Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings over the coming months to try and hand control to creditors. They owe so much money and struggling to attract young customers in particular. And it's all very sudden. Their revenues fell by 100 million last year, still making 800 million a year. But the share price plunged 90% in just a year. Why? Oprah Winfrey stepped down as a member of the board of Weight Watchers after nearly 10 years and admitted she had started using weight loss drugs as a maintenance tool. So they're hoping to restructure, but it looks like it's over for that dieting industry for sure.
The Crackometer was untroubled by that story, I think it's fair to say. Maybe the spies in Ireland's tech industry story will be funnier.
Now, there's a Russian spy ship floating off the coast of County Mayo. A Russian Navy intelligence gathering ship is being tracked through Irish controlled waters and is refusing to respond to communications from the naval service. The Viktor Leonov, 300-foot vessel, very fetching-looking vessel, from the Russian Navy's Northern Fleet, was spotted by the Irish Naval Service, and it's being tracked by the L.E. Samuel Beckett. So Beckett is waiting for them to get in contact with them. So they got in touch. The communications apparently was accepted. It was like the two ticks on the WhatsApp. So they've read it, but they didn't say anything back. Defence sources say the Beckett has attempted to hail the Leonov and establish his purpose in Irish-controlled waters, not our territorial seas, which extend 22 kilometres from our coastline, but in our economic area zone, as it's designated, in the EEZ. It has broken no maritime laws, but previous sightings have raised concerns. Russia is mapping our seabed and infrastructure. I hope somebody is, anyway, but not for these nefarious purposes. And our data cables, oh, that's the bit that connects us to the internet worldwide.
Again, informative rather than gut-busting. But you know, maybe I'm taking things a little bit too literally, and Friday Crack is all in the ear of whatever the aural version of Beholder is. It's the weekend, and that means sport. And when you put weekend and sport together, you are legally obliged, if you work in the media, to include the word massive.
It's a massive weekend for sport, by the way, and the Masters has gone well. Rory McIlroy's the great hope, wasn't he, again? Derailed by a horrible finish to his first round of this 89th Masters. Two double bogeys in the closing four holes. Basically, he was going really well, 14 holes in, and then the 15th, he fell asunder. There's something about the Masters that just seems to unravel in Rory McIlroy's mind. He was in great form yesterday. You might have seen there that his daughter, 4-year-old Poppy, putted from 30 feet out at the Masters in the kind of fun, family-friendly thing. And Shane Lowry was there as well with her, his young one. But the costly late errors have left him slipping. McIlroy to a level par, 72. Level par, the Justin Rose is leading it off. He's 7 shots under, so he's well off the pace. It's not going to happen for McIlroy. I hope I'm wrong, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen, which would mean 39 majors in a row without a win. You have to go back to 2014 since he last won a major when he was flying as a young fella, and things seem to be going well in his life. But it's a mental game. It's a mental sport. It goes on for the weekend. We're watching Shane Lowry, who's on par basically at the moment, and it goes on. It goes on and on and on. The Women's Six Nations is tomorrow. There's a break last weekend. Amy Lee Costigan is going to captain Ireland. There are 3 changes to the side for the Women's Six Nations meeting England in Cork. Is where that's happening. England, obviously, really difficult. They scored 14 tries the last time we met in the Six Nations, and they went ahead the third grand, the sixth time. They're going for their 7th Six Nations in a row, the English, but they've been professionals for longer than any other team in the Six Nations. We've done well, actually. We had wins over Australia and New Zealand recently, and we got off to a good start when we beat Italy there recently. It was a record win, indeed, that one as well. England currently on top, 10 points, followed by France and then Ireland on 5. So that begins. It's live on RT2 tomorrow at 4:45, basically. But tonight, Leinster are playing Glasgow. That's on Lansdowne Road. And they're very hopeful in Leinster in the Champions Cup, the European Cup. They beat Harlequin 62-0 in Croke Park. And now they have Glasgow. It won't be as easy, but they are expected to win that, to be fair. Munster beat La Rochelle, of course, last week. They're off to Bordeaux. Bordeaux beat Ulster last Sunday, and Joey Carberry, this is the interesting bit. Joey Carberry is of course playing for Bordeaux now, former Munster player, and he knows Munster very, very well. And there was a very interesting interview, I don't know if you read last weekend in the Irish Times, Carberry talking about leaving Ireland to play in France and having a great time there, and he's talking about the lovely life they have in beautiful Bordeaux, and his wife and young son are enjoying the French lifestyle, and of course the life of a number 10. You get to watch Johnny Sexton for years, now Jack Crowley and Sam Prendergast, so that's why he's over in Bordeaux. That's where he on this evening, also live on RT television. And of course there's GAA across the weekend. Tyrone Cavan up in Ulster with the pick of the action. Dublin begin their campaign against Wicklow in Aughrim. It's like the football championship gets a bit mad. Outside of the Ulster championship, not much competition for months. There are going to be 53 matches just to knock out 4 teams in the GAA football championship. What are they doing? Jumping back to the Masters, a story that's doing the rounds this morning is a Spanish amateur, José Luis Ballester. He relieved himself into basically one of the ponds on the. And this is a pristine golf club, Augusta National, Rays Creek. He urinated from a ledge, said he couldn't find, he didn't know where the bathrooms were. So he had to go. He was on the 13th hole, and he's unapologetic because he's Spanish. I had to do it. I would do it again. That sounded Italian, actually. Desolé. Lo siento. If I had to do it, I would do it again. There you go. Okay, there's the stereotypes. 21-year-old, he's playing alongside Scotty Scheffler and Justin Thomas. Sprinted away from the fairway after playing his 3rd shot. In incredible scenes, he got an ovation from the galleries. There's no footage of this, by the way, because you can't bring mobile phones into the Augusta National. Somebody was thrown out the other day for wearing shorts. They're very fussy people. And he's done that, and I'd say he's going to get a stern talking to. Also, apparently, it looks different, the course, this year, because lots of trees were knocked down in the storms and all of that.
Obviously, independent TD for Roscommon Galway, Michael Fitzmaurice, has taken his anti-tree agenda to Augusta. That's a little reference to yesterday's Playback Daily, by the way. Anyway, that's probably more than enough Friday crack for one show, so let's leave the Oliver Callan monologue there for today. Agreed? Dara Cailleary, Minister for Social Protection and Rural and Community Development, spoke to Claire Byrne this morning about the government's free school meals programme.
My predecessor, Regina Doherty, in 2019 had a pilot scheme of 30 schools for hot school meals at primary level. And now we're going to go to 2,850. So that's a huge increase since 2019, a huge investment. And we're bringing an extra 713 primary schools on board today. As part of that expansion, I am asking the Department of Health, and I'm funding at the Department of Health, to do a report on the nutrition, because I've heard your own show over the last while. I've read reports that there are concerns around nutrition, but I've engaged a really good engagement here. I'm speaking to you from St. Philip's School in Clonsilla. Really good engagement with a supplier here this morning, going through their processes. They have 30 choices for children, very much focused on health, very much focused on local suppliers. And that's where I want this to be, that local suppliers, nutritious, but that we have it available in every primary school in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I have experience of the hot school meals as well in my own family. And, you know, every day there is a choice on that menu, something like a chicken fillet roll, a sausage baguette, pizza and wedges. Is that what you would expect from that system?
Well, we're moving on a changing that from September, foods that is high in saturated fat, high in sugar and high in salt will be removed from the choices.
Completely gone.
We'll be engaging. Yeah, you know, we have, they're there as what's known as the treat day for Friday, a lot of it, Claire. We're removing that. It's also a choice. You know, it's a choice of the parents or a choice of the children. So it's not enforced on them.
Yeah, I know, but it does. So I know what you're saying, that it's there on a Friday. It's actually there's at least one poor choice there every day in my experience. I'm sure in the experience of a lot of parents around the country. And it sets you up for a battle with your child when you have to navigate that ordering process and that choice is there. So you're saying it'll be gone Monday to Thursday, it'll be there on a Friday.
We're going to restrict any food that is high in saturated fat, high in sugar, high in salt from the program entirely from September. And we're going to focus in with suppliers on foods that, you know, are high in nutrition. But, you know, you also have to, they're tough audiences, and, you know, you have to engage the pupils in this as well. And we had a really good discussion with sixth class here. They gave us some ideas as to what they like. Overall, though, they liked the food that was on offer. They liked the healthy food that was on offer. They got the link at sixth class in terms of nutrition, food, and their ability to study. Mm-hmm. It is difficult when you have a cohort of children from 5 or 6 up to 13, they all have different needs, and we're trying to capture that.
What prompted you, Minister, to want to remove the fat, the sugar and the salt? Were there particular menu choices that you saw on those menus where you said that's just not acceptable?
No, when I took over on the 23rd of January, you know, obviously, I'm very much aware from my own friends, my own even discussions you cover quite regularly, that there are concerns around the menu choices. And this is one of the issues that I raised with officials. It had been raised before. We, Toronto Social Protection, led out in 2024. We set up an interdepartmental committee with the Department of Health and the Department of Education exactly around this, around the scheme, around the nutrition. So, you know, there was a lot of work done before I came in terms of addressing nutrition and putting nutrition at the heart of the program, and doing that while expanding it. You know, I think, Claire, while we're focusing on this, we have gone from 30 schools in 2019, and by this September we have over 3,000 schools, and I think that needs to be taken into account and remembered as well.
Yeah,
that
a lot of people welcome the fact that the hot school meal is there, but it's a golden opportunity to get it right and to teach children about the food, the importance of preparation, the importance of healthy food and the importance of Irish food and locally sourced food.
And I want to do that. And I, you know, really struck by the supplier I met here today, Midlands based, supplying 500 schools right around the country. You know, looking at their supplier list, they're focusing on Irish suppliers, on local suppliers. I've looked at the technology they're using in terms of keeping the food warm. And, you know, we want to do that. And yes, where there are people not living up to that standard, then they will be rooted out. I want to increase the inspections that we do. I want to increase the depth of those inspections across the country. But I will do that in the framework of expert advice from nutritionists, people who are actually qualified in this space. And I've asked the Department of Health to get that report to me by the end of this year, by the end of this calendar year. And we will make calls and make decisions based on that report. Mm-hmm. But overall, Claire, as I said, this is a big investment on the part of the Department of Social Protection.
And you've said that you'll be up to 3,000 schools. Is 320 a day enough to provide hot food per pupil?
Look, I've seen, I've looked at the school here. I mean, I've looked at the supplier, the options that they're giving on that budget, and, you know, they're delivering that. But, you know, we will look at what the nutritionist comes back to me with, and we will engage with the Department of Public Expenditure if there is a need to. But certainly from the supplier I've seen here this morning, 30 different options. The majority of them, Claire, very vast majority of them, are what I would call nutritious and healthy, and have good local suppliers at their heart. And they're doing that on the existing budget.
You mentioned waste there. And in some cases, I know it's not the same everywhere, but in some cases, you'll have a five-year-old child in junior infants getting the same size portion as somebody in sixth class. And most of it will come home in that case. Is that something that you want to address?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want food waste. I don't, you know, I just really don't want to see that in any part of any of our schemes. You know, food is such an important commodity, and there are many people who don't get enough of it. So I don't want to be facilitating the waste of it. And we're going to look at that in terms of portions and that. As you said, though, that is in the minority cases. I am struck, as I've been preparing over the last few weeks for this, the amount of attention that's going into portions, the amount of attention and work that's going into address allergy issues, which are very, very important. The amount of schools that have no nut policies in terms of their school meals. And the whole basis of this scheme, Claire, is that it's dealt with at school level deliberately so that it can be responsive to the specific needs of specific schools.
That's Minister for Social Protection, Dara Khalili, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the government's expanded free school meals programme. Oliver Cannon was talking about the Russian ship Viktor Leonov, anchored in Irish waters off the coast of Mayo, and on this afternoon's Liveline came the news that the ship has now left. Joe Duffy spoke to Patrick Murphy, member of the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation.
Well, we always concerned when we have foreign vessels coming into our waters, not knowing what they're doing here. We've had this conversation many times.
And what? He's gone now, apparently, but he refused to respond to communications from our naval service. Nothing we can do much about it. We don't even have any people on our ships that can qualify to fire the cannons. Not that we want to start World War III. Are there many ships doing exercises down there, Patrick? Have you noticed?
Well, we were never notified, Joe, but we see vessels and military vessels. We had four French naval vessels in our waters at one stage. So we know that they do a lot of exercises in the Irish Sea and the Celtic Sea and up north. And the UK do a lot of exercises, especially underwater. We've spoken to commanders of ex-commanders of the British Navy, like that would be going in submarines.
The French and the British, without them, we'd have no protection. Both on land, on sea and air especially. But what about the Russians? Because you spotted them before. You went up to because they try and implement an exclusion zone. You went up to Rotgar and you met the Russian ambassador, and he was a hail fellow well met, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, well, that was different, Joe. They were actually telling the aviation services to fly over our own area, like, you know, that was a bit cheeky. So when we were told that we too might be allowed to go fishing, we drew the line there. So the fishermen decided to say no, and that we went up and we negotiated, and we did negotiate with them, and they withdrew, and we were very, very happy with that, to be honest with you, because it's a very important fishery and a very important seafloor grounds. You don't want to be trawling with unexploded ordnance, that, you know, what goes up must come down.
Absolutely.
But like, And Joe, I must say now at this juncture, we wouldn't have had half the success with the likes of yourself giving us the platform to let people know what was going on, because it was people power you know, that did that and all over the world. So thanks very much for that, Joe. And we are delighted as always to talk to you.
And Patrick, and likewise. But if you try and make radio contact with the other ships, regardless of nationality, obviously military ships, do they respond?
Oh, they're obligated to, Joe, yeah, because of navigation hazards, and they have to have AIS on, like, you know, so the boats have to be seen for navigation purposes, all vessels, including fishing vessels. So, like, that's safety at sea, and there's a collision regulation there as well. So, yeah, they are duty-bound to answer you, and if not, then you would be looking for the likes of the military to get involved. Like, you know, you can't have rogue ships coming through your waters. Look, they could be anything. We've had boats coming in with drugs and everything, Joe, coming through our waters from all over the world. So, like, we have... And I keep saying this, Joe, our naval services aren't resourced enough. We are losing very good people out of those services. One of the lads came up to me. He was in the Navy, his generation, three generations, and his nephew was in. And they were actually bought out by a local company in Ringsend. You know, 30 of them, 30 apprentices for electronics, and all their contracts were bought out. So it left a huge gap of services for the naval. And so I'll keep taking the opportunity, Joe, if you don't mind, to say that we really need to support our men and women, and in the other defence forces as well, too, in fairness. They put their lives on the line, Joe. Yeah.
And there's a massive recruitment drive at the minute, and the ads look very exciting, both for Navy, land and air. They look very... So there is a massive recruitment drive, and Jennifer Carl McNeill, when she was in charge of defence in her ministry, the entrance salary went up dramatically, and they're forever trying to get that across to people. But obviously it's not working at this stage, but it seems to be a much better career in our military.ie than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. But as you say, the skills are so high that they're in demand by private companies.
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. And look, as I said, these are skilled, highly skilled and specialised people. Like, and, you know, we might have to give a bit more, Joe. It's like hiring a consultant over a doctor. You know, the consultant has the better education, the more skill set and everything else. So they deserve to get a bit more. And I say the same for our specialists in these areas. And if you want to keep the talent and the skill that's there, you're going to have to pay for it, like anything.
And Patrick, have you ever... Apparently there's... ships that have no crew, not the Marie Celeste, but ships that are electronically. Oh, yes. Have you come across them?
Yeah, we have, and we've great concern over them, Joe, because dark nights and everything, fellas are steaming around, you know, in waters, and these are very close to the surface. They're autonomous vehicles. They're for surveying, Joe, would you believe it, and mapping the seafloor and stuff like that for offshore, all manner of offshore industries. So we are concerned about that, but we have notified the department about that. There's five there at the moment, Joe. That's a lot.
And they run their commercial operations.
Yeah, commercial, Joe.
Okay,
yeah,
they're
yeah,
not
yeah.
Military. Look, so they'd have to get permission.
Our job. Yes, but we would like it to be a little bit more stringent and a little bit more. I suppose, known to what's going on out there, Joe. Like, you know, we've vessels steaming down there. Before a fishing vessel belonging to our lads leaves port, within a 4-hour window, he has to call into the FMC, Fishery Monitoring Control, in Ringsend. And they have to tell him what time they're leaving, the area they're going to. If they don't manage to leave within the 4 hours, then they have to recall in again.
Okay.
I was explaining this as well. Even passenger ships, Joe, they have to give a time of departure and when they're leaving and call in to let people know that they're en route, you know.
Of course,
I worked in that area myself. So the same goes for anything on the water. We'd be hoping for the same rules to be applied just for safety and marine navigation, you know.
Patrick Murphy, a member of the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation, talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the mysterious Russian ship Viktor Leonov, which has today departed Irish waters. Good news, everyone! Ireland is about to get its very own Fashion Week. US-born and Irish-raised Ashley MacDonald joined Oliver Callan this morning to answer the question, does Ireland need its own Fashion Week?
I think a couple of years ago, we maybe wouldn't have been ready, but right now,
especially in the last 48 hours, I realised the appetite is there because I've been inundated with messages, not just from fashion designers, but also set designers, photographers, videographers, makeup artists, hairstylists. Everyone wants to get involved. And we have probably, I would say, 10 times more designers that want to show than what we're actually even able to produce this year. Wow. So we're going to have 7 fashion shows from October 6th until October 10th. And like you said, it's going to cost us around €1 million to produce all of that. But it's nothing in comparison to the cost of shows that are being produced on a global scale, like in Paris, where, for example, Dior had their show here in March and they spent €1 million just on flowers for the show.
Oh my God.
€1 million for us across all 7 shows and 5 events for the week. I think we have to start strong, and I think it's a feasible budget for us to begin with, and I'm sure we're going to grow it every year.
The largesse is incredible. Fashion, it is your life, isn't it, fashion? What age were you when you started?
I moved to Paris when I was 19, and I was lucky enough to start my career with LVMH, so they own Louis Vuitton and many other brands, and I spent a couple of years with them and Dior. And now I'm with another luxury group called Pooch, and we own over 30 luxury brands, makeup brands like Charlotte Tilbury, but also lots of fashion brands like Jean-Paul Gaultier, Carolina Herrera, and Paco Rabanne. So this is what I live and breathe.
That's a great success. Do you feel you had to leave Ireland, though, to make it in fashion?
I did. And I feel that that's such a pity. And when we look at the big names in fashion from Ireland today, they've all had to leave. You know, J.W. Anderson, he's been creative director at Loewe for over 10 years, Simone Rocha, Sean McGurr. And it's normal that we didn't have the industry before. We're much later to the game than the French or the Italians, but the moment is now, and that's why this investment is required to help bolster the industry and give it a strong foundation.
Yeah, you need the investment. It's £1 million, but it's pittance compared to what goes on in the global fashion world. But it'll spread quite a bit, won't it, in October?
It will. And it's over 5 days. So what we're doing now is we've put together a team. We opened our office in Dublin this week. We have our first 2 employees working on this already, pulling in, you know, the partnerships and sponsorships and all of the various different vendors that we need to actually produce this. There will be open applications so designers can apply for a show. We have 7 different shows, all the way, you know, starting with a graduate show, all the way up to flagship and spotlight shows, which would be huge productions for brands that can do a collection of 40 looks. So there is something in there for all sizes of brands, as long as they're culturally relevant to Ireland and that they're commercially viable, you know, even if they're really in early stages. But they have to have a business plan, they have to have a vision, and they have to have a connection to Ireland. That's the brands that we want to support with this week.
To make it live up to the name, Irish Fashion Week. And Camille, Ashley, what's your hope that these designers will be put before visitors from around the world who will come here in October and see the wares?
Yes, so, I mean, for my 10 plus years now in the industry, what I'll be doing is bringing over the international media and press. We have 3 different Vogue publications that are coming over. We have Forbes that are coming. And that list will keep growing because people are excited as well to see what's going to happen in this first Ireland Fashion Week. So the goal is put Ireland on the map, not just nationally. I think we have to convince a lot of people in Ireland as well that we can do fashion, but absolutely on the international stage. And all of the selected designers will be receiving support post-show from Ireland Fashion Week as well. So they'll be receiving access to the latest technologies, the latest platforms. We have some amazing partners that are giving us their licensing fees completely free of charge for 12 months for Irish fashion designers to help them with trend forecasting, to help them with designing. So these are, you know, tools that the biggest and most successful brands in the world are using and paying for. So it's a golden opportunity really for brands to throw in their hat, you know, do everything they can with their application, because this goes far beyond just the show. We want to give them a springboard to actually build viable businesses as well.
Great. And what's the week going to look like itself? What sort of events will people be looking out for in October?
So we kick off on the Monday, 6th of October. We'll have 2 shows in Dublin that day. One is going to be actually on a running track. That'll be for our sportswear brand. So I'm sure we can imagine having a lot of our big Irish sports stars attending, but also walking in the show. The evening will be our streetwear show. So that's going to be in Dublin City as well, which we'll be announcing very soon. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're going regional with the shows. We'll have our graduate show, our independent designers show, and we'll also have our heritage show. So that'll be one of the Irish heritage brands that will hopefully be taking that spot. And then on the Friday, we take it back to Dublin. We'll have our finale, which will be in Dublin City. It's going to be a very modern show. Again, all of these shows are up for grabs, so brands can apply for them. We subsidise by up to 95% the cost of them. Ah, and then we finish the week with our after party on the Friday for all of the featured designers and major press and whatnot from the week. We have, for example, picture this frontman, Ryan Hennessy, on our board to help us bring in all of the big names. We've got the head of social media from Stella McCartney as well. We've got amazing people on board to help bring Irish fashion to a global stage and do it in a really cool and desirable way as well.
That sounds really good. And it's an open call, is it, to designers to get in touch?
It is an open call.
How do they get in touch?
April 23rd. They can follow us on Ireland Fashion Week across all social media. They can also subscribe to our newsletter. That's available on all our social pages. So on April 23rd, that will be going live. And it'll be live for 1 month. So there'll be online applications and then an interview round. And the first week of June, we'll be announcing which brands are going to take all of those show spots.
It sounds like you're going to be very busy for the next couple of weeks.
It's going to be very busy.
Will you be able to keep your job going as well in Paris?
Well, luckily I've got a full team on board now in Dublin, so they'll be handling a lot of the operations. But I think, you know, the big challenge with these things is having the vision, having the connections and having the financing. So that's what I'm able to bring to the table. And then I let the experts in all of those different areas take over and they'll work their magic.
And the drive, of course, it's the idea and the put into action. So you've got a good team of staff there ready to go. So April 23rd is kind of the deadline for the opportunity, is it, the applications?
April 23rd, we go live with the applications and there'll be a full 4 weeks for people to apply. So they can start thinking now about how are they going to make this happen. And then April 23rd onwards for 4 weeks, they'll be able to throw in their hat.
Do you have the venue already booked for that big finale event? Where is that going to happen in Dublin?
We do. I can't say where it's going to be yet, but we actually visited it last week and yeah, we're very excited. So all will be revealed.
It's all a tease. It's proper fashion.
Yeah,
it's proper fashion. It's all a tease.
Well, you know, most fashion shows, they only tell you about a week before, are sometimes very secretive and mysterious brands. They don't tell you till the day before. So we might keep one or two like that.
Drafting my application right now. That's Ashley McDonald talking to Oliver Callan this morning about how she's organising Ireland's first Fashion Week. Japan has an obesity rate of under 5%. Maybe, some people have postulated, we could learn from them and start to get our own numbers under control. Claire Byrne spoke to Fiona Uema, founder of Fused, and Helen Heenahan, a consultant bariatric surgeon and professor of surgery at St. Vincent's Hospital, this morning to try to get an idea of what we can learn from our friends in the East. Claire put the first question to Helen.
In your view and experience, and I know you've looked very closely at Japan, how much of that is down to culture and environment and how much of it is down to just genetics?
It's multifactorial, Claire, and it's, you know, Japanese people, I actually did assume that they were genetically predisposed to a leaner body type. And actually, when I looked more into it over the last few days, I found that that's not necessarily true. You know, they're genetically as at risk of obesity as most people in the Western world. In fact, there have been really nice genetic studies done that have looked at heritability of various traits linked to obesity. You know, there are hundreds of genetic variants, but there's 17 strong, pretty strong ones. And Japanese people have the same susceptibility to those genetic variants as Europeans and people in the Western world. So it's largely due, I think, to environment and culture. And we see that as well when people of Japanese origin move to a Western world, their obesity rates will increase in a different westernized environment.
Right. Even though I would imagine at this stage in Japan, and Fiona will tell us about this as well, I'm sure they're exposed to elements at least of the Western diet, right?
Yeah, they do seem to be, but not to the same. I don't think it has taken hold to the same extent it has here or in other Western countries. So the fast food environment just hasn't taken hold in the same way that it has elsewhere.
Right. Well, Fiona, you live there, so you're a good person to talk to about this. I mean, even though they are exposed to, you know, what we eat and to fast food culture, they clearly have more respect for food and what they're eating and think more about it, do they, than we do? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose I'm a case study of that. When I went to live in Japan, my waistline just naturally slimmed down. you know, it just happened. And I suppose I can tell you why, and it wasn't a conscious thing. And similarly, when my Japanese friends came to live in Ireland, they put on weight. So it's just from looking at that, it's
your,
not that they're
your evidence, right?
Evidence
there
of it. But, you know, it's really, it's not a magic bullet, one thing. It's the things that happen from when you wake up to when you go to bed that are integrated into the society and how you live there. And even as a foreigner going into their country. So, you know, if you look at their mindset to eating, harahachi bu, 80% full, you never eat until you're completely stuffed. Portion control, the size of the portions they serve are smaller. So it's okay not to be absolutely full. It's okay to eat sweet things and have treats, but you might just have a mouthful. So you don't really deprive yourself of anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're eating healthy food, but it's really tasty. And it's the diversity of, I think people had used the term triangular eating, you know, the bento box. You always serve it with soup. So the soup is kind of giving you that sense of fullness.
So a light soup, like a miso soup.
Exactly. But then it's how exercise and movement is integrated so naturally into their society. So the walking and cycling to school. Is just a natural thing. It's safe for kids to walk and cycle to school, and parents will be along the way as checkpoints. It just happens naturally in towns and villages. So you would vary. It's not really normal to see people in cars going to school.
Right. We were talking about the hot school meals here with the minister a little earlier. So that culture around food, it starts at that stage, does it? Clearly in the home, but in education as well.
Exactly. So the whole country supports a healthy system, the government, the schools, the companies. So I worked in a school for 2 years, and it was just so nice to experience that, how passion for food and education is instilled into the education system. And, you know, I have a 10-year-old, and his biggest thing is there's not a dedicated time really for eating. It's quite rushed, and they feel like if they take extra time eating, they suffer on their playtime. But, you know, and that's kind of not, I suppose, a positive thing. In Japan, you have that designated time to eat in the school. And obviously they have a healthy school lunch with a nutritionist inside the school. But it's education on food, the seasonality of food, how to read food labels. That's just all in the school curriculum.
And is the food supplied by the school, or how does it work?
So the food is made in the school. They have staff to make the food in the school. They have a full-time nutritionist. But the thing that stood out to me is the kids are part of the rota system. The meal just doesn't land there for them. They have to help set it up, prepare the tron a little apron. So they take turns doing that. So I think it's that sense of building an appetite and appreciating the meal too. And I think that they have a leftover chart, and they all get excited about it. How much leftover food did we have? How can we reduce it? So they're all invested in it.
So that's a very different attitude, Helen.
Yeah.
I'm sure you would agree to what we see here.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's a lot that actually they legislate for in Japan as well, Claire, which shows that, you know, this doesn't happen by accident. Mm-hmm. So like Fiona's alluded to some of the things they do in school, like it's mandatory that there is one of the teachers has a nutrition qualification. So at least 3 years of training in nutrition. The principal is also involved in, I believe, and I haven't lived or travelled there yet, but that, you know, principal's involved in the procurement of food, really healthy food as well for the school. But separately, even from an employer's perspective, really, you know, we find this controversial. It wasn't at all in Japan, but in 2008 they introduced a law called the Metabo Law, and it was a law concerning the promotion of health and prevention of metabolic disease in the population. The one thing about Japanese or people who live in Japan or of Japanese heritage, and people generally in Southeast Asia, if they do gain weight, it can make them really unwell from a metabolic health point of view. They're more at risk of metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes. So they have to work really hard to avoid, you know, an unhealthy population. So the Metabo Law introduced in 2008 to combat obesity required employers and local governments to measure the waistlines of employees and all residents over the age of 40.
No, we'd be horrified. Can you imagine? Can you imagine if we did that here?
And I believe Japanese people can't understand our reaction to that. To that, they're, you know, whether, I don't know if Fiona could corroborate this, a more compliant society or just do what's right for themselves individually, but also collectively and societally. And, you know, when individuals don't get fined or penalised if their waistline is increasing on an annual basis, but if a number of employees, if a certain percentage in an environment are over the threshold, which isn't much, it's 35 inches for women and 33.5 inches for men, then there are certain kind of penalties. But more importantly as well, if people's waistlines are increasing, they are supported. You know, they're given various different supports, both from a dietary point of view, from an education point of view, and from a motivational point of view.
Yeah,
well, directly and in groups.
Fiona, we might get your perspective on that. I mean, I mentioned how horrified we would be if that, you know, was introduced here. But are you aware that it's very accepted in Japan?
Yeah, like, there's a thing called Taiso in Japan. So in a Japanese company, I was really embarrassed when we first had to do it. You do 5 minutes exercise. That's how you start the day. It comes on the speakers and everyone stands up in their suits and starts moving and jumping up and down. And I remember when I first had to do it, I was absolutely mortified, but it's so normal for them. So, but yeah, they talk about obesity in a very honest and open way that we wouldn't in Ireland. I suppose they're very factual about it. You know, if you're carrying weight, you're not healthy, or you're more susceptible to certain diseases. So they talk very factually about it. They don't mean to be offensive. It's not offensive for them, but we may perceive it that way here. So it's probably a cultural thing as well. So they're just very mindful of their health and their activities throughout the day.
So the measuring of the waist, they would see that as something that is there to help them maintain their
health. Absolutely, yeah.
And accept it for that reason.
And thankful for it, I think, mm-hmm. because then they would see they'd have more longevity, they'd be healthier into their older age, you know. So, yeah, they don't see it as a negative.
Happens every day here in RTE. You never get used to it. That's Fiona Uema, founder of Fused, discussing Japan's low obesity rate with consultant bariatric surgeon Helen Heenahan and Claire Byrne this morning. On this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show, the musical trio of Fiachna O'Brienon, Tom Dunn and Alan Connor dropped into studio for a chat and some tunes. As we join them here, Alan seems to have done something of a runner.
People probably don't know this, but Alan, who plays keyboard with you, he plays keyboard in the Late Late Show house band.
He sure does.
He does. Yes.
He's an extraordinary musician.
Yeah, we joke about it. He's a bit of a genius, really. Yeah. You know, every now and again, something comes in and says something like, which one of you is the talented one? And we always point at him.
It's Alan. It's Alan, without question.
Best cars, best dog, whatever is good option
best
in
hair.
Life.
Best hair.
Yeah, he's got everything, you know. Yeah.
And we can talk at will, because he's not here.
Yeah, he drives some beautiful cars. Yes, actually, a bit of a car head.
And extremely talented.
Yeah, very bright. I remember there was some electrical problem in his car. And he went to bed then after that gig in Mike the Pies, and he woke up the next day and he'd solved it.
That's amazing.
He'd been on the internet during the night and he said, yeah, 1963 has an electrical problem. Some of them got recalled on the strength of it. If I open the car door and close it three times, it'll be fixed.
Amazing.
And that's just the way he is.
Yeah.
That's just the way he is.
Are you a threesome? A trio, sorry.
Yeah, I suppose we are. That sounds very...
Yeah, a trio.
Yes. Yeah, we are. It's. I have to say, it's about 2 years now, isn't it? Mm. It's a lovely little, I think you called it a little gift that fell into our laps
on this very programme.
Yeah. Because the big were those bridges that had to be built. You know, something happens and can do 9 songs in 17 minutes.
Yeah.
The Flowers wouldn't have even finished an intro in that time. You wouldn't see those worlds going together, would you?
No.
You know, it happens very big on footwear. Yes. Every one of us, you know, very strong. Wouldn't go on stage without your footwear, I'd say.
I mean, to play guitar and to sing harmonies with somebody who wears shoes.
And linen wasn't big with something happens. Linen wasn't big.
No, linen wasn't part of our agenda at all.
It was Paisley, not Parsley, yeah. Paisley.
And the set list printed out probably a week before the gig.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to change, you'd need to send a fax in and have your reasons why you want to change one of the songs.
It's all very worked out.
If you see a set list, it's a miracle. A miracle.
Yeah.
Just see where the ether
takes
you.
Got rid of them a long time ago.
So you come out to play, what, twice a year or once a year?
Or more than that. God, yeah. We're playing. Oh, yeah, we're
when I say in blocks, you know what I mean? I don't mean...
So
you're in Town Hall, Galway, 19th of April. Then in October, it's Ballycotton. The Mermaid in Bray, and then in November, Pavilion in Dunleary for two nights. Right. And then December, the Oriel Centre in Dundalk. And you have a live album at the Pavilion, it's called.
We're just about to announce, in fact, on Monday, I think November the 8th in Belfast at the
Very
Waterfront.
Right.
We've got a little room at the Waterfront that will accommodate. You know,
it happens, still do gigs. In fact, June the, I think it's the 18th or the 14th, it's the 35th anniversary of the God's Glue album. Can you believe
that?
Amazing. And we're doing Whelans with that. But it's hard to get all four of them together.
All busy.
Yeah. So yeah. All have gone on to different careers.
Will you tell our listeners that, like, a few years ago, you didn't play guitar?
No.
Yeah.
And when COVID arrived, I had an existential crisis, the same way as everyone else did. And loads of songs started to come to me. And I couldn't do anything with them because I need to be in a room with a band. That's really how I ended up writing songs.
Right. Yeah.
So I was singing them into my phone and thinking, where do I go next? What do I do with these? And I thought, I have to learn to play guitar. I've put it off long enough. I've been in a room with a man who can really play it and coasted on that. Mm-hmm. So I got down to it. I got lessons and nothing makes you learn guitar faster than going on stage with two other musicians. I'll tell you that. You quickly.
Did you dream about it?
Being on
you didn't have any nightmares about being on stage and not knowing the chords or
they're actually waking dreams that that kind of stuff has actually happened. But you know, they say to you, they kind of, those who know more, they say, you know, and if you lose your way, just, you know, hold just the chords dead and just kind of pull your hands up and down. So that's not actually a chord, it's just a rhythm.
Make it a rhythm.
And people look like you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you get through it. It's fine.
1965, a big year in your life, Faith, because it was the start of your life.
It was the start of my life on the 27th of November, 1965, towards the end of it, yeah. My parents got married in February and I came along literally 9.5 months later.
Right. Honeymoon baby.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And I told you already, Ben Stiller, Robert Downey Jr., all celebrating their 60th birthdays this year.
Yep.
Home Call for Yourself, Chris Rock, Bjork, all there. And tomorrow is World Record Store Day. We were talking to a guy called Ray O'Brien, who has a record shop down in Toker.
In Cork. He's a great guy.
Lovely guy.
Yeah,
lovely
great guy.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about, you know, your first vinyl.
Yes.
LP single. So we might as well ask you the same question as well. Tom?
I feel my sister will ring in and say he's lying. But I have been given loads of presents of vinyl. I have all them. So I do have Kung Fu Fighting on vinyl.
Right.
But the first one I can remember buying was The Boys Are Back in Town. Because I was just blown away by the fact that an Irish band were doing so well.
Then Fiachna drops the bombshell that Phil Lynott once offered to play bass with Hothouse Flowers.
Did he really?
He was at our third ever gig in the Magic Carpet in Cornwall Square, and we had no bass player in the lineup at all. There was just piano and guitar and drums and me, and Philo was at the gig. And afterwards he said, look, I'll do a single with you and I'll play bass on it. And it just never happened. I mean, a huge tragedy.
But, what a story that would be now for our shows. We had that to tell Fiacre.
And was there a story as well about Bruce Shields auditioning Phil Lynott for Skid Row or something like that? And
he kicked him out.
He kicked him out, did he? Okay.
Yeah, and to make it up to him, he showed him how to play bass.
All right. Does Fiacre remember playing as the Benzini Brothers with Liam in UCD, Great Crack, and some quite risque songs?
Risque?
Risque songs, you see.
Yeah.
I remember it very well. I mean, playing in Belfield, I went to Belfield for just under a year and then I started my second year. And during the first summer holidays, I went busking on Grafton Street with Liam every day and we ended up doing the Late Late Show and we ended up doing lots of gigs. But busking in Belfield was the Belfield Bar. We used to do gigs there. And then I remember getting calls at like midday saying, can you do a gig like literally in an hour on the lake? And Liam and I just rocked up and did this gig on the lake. Thousands of people out in front of us. And it was sheer, unbridled joy and
freedom. Is that actually how it happened, Tom? Or is that
something happens of no such stories. Our stories are all far less glamorous. It's trying to get into nightclubs that won't let us in.
We'll bring him down a peg or two with his first song that he bought. What's the first song you bought?
Well, the first album I bought was, I was 12 years old when Saturday Night Fever came out. And it was 15s here and I wasn't allowed to go to it. But I ended up in Paris on holidays with some family friends there. And it was only 13s there and I was quite tall and, you know, a bit of a moustache developing and went to see it. So consequently, the first album I bought was the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack.
Just before they went and played a tune, Ray had an accusation to hurl at Tom.
Tom, you're writing a children's book.
Yeah, I've been very taken by a thing. Barry Devlin said that in 1972 there was nothing in Ireland. And then horselips form and slowly, you know, it's like it goes into colour and music arrives. So it's how Irish music changed the world. It's very focused. It's actually, it's aimed towards younger audience, and it's going to be illustrated. And there's, you know, I play fast and loose with the truth.
Do you feature in it?
No, I don't think we're quite. It kind of ends when you two go on the cover of Time magazine.
I'd be interested to see how you represent Van Morrison in it.
He's very well represented. Yes. Yeah, George Ivan Morrison. Yeah, I'll give you his name and address, because he was one of the only three people in Ireland who were allowed to make original music during the 60s and the early 70s.
Tom Dunn on his children's book, along with current musical partner Fiachna O'Brien, talking to Ray D'Arcy this afternoon. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the Oliver Callan Torture Well-Known People slot, or Visiting Critic as the show calls it, this week welcomed the biologist, author, broadcaster, Renaissance woman that is Aina Ní Lána. Aina was sent to try her hand at meditation, and it's probably fair to say she was not impressed.
Well, that's an hour of my life that I'll never get back.
Oh, my God. Everybody we send usually enjoys the thing
that you're sent to. Yeah.
Okay. Well, right.
I was sent to a lovely Buddhist centre. It was a really nice place. Yeah. And I arrived in the evening time for a class from 7 until 8:15. Right. And 24 people arrived, 8 men and 16 women. And nobody would see 40 again except on a bus. So that was the kind of the age group of them. And we were brought into this lovely room with lovely soft chairs and white walls. And up at the front where you might have an altar or something, there was a large glass case, the full width of the room. And inside the glass case, there were about 10 statues of Buddhas.
Oh, yeah,
and the
lovely.
Buddhas were all sitting up with their legs crossed in. I don't know how they got their legs in that way or how they'd ever get them out.
He's
again.
A happy looking fella as well.
Well, he was sitting with his legs crossed. I mean, God knows, there was big ones and little ones. And then there was one of these gods that has four arms, two this way and two that way. So I had a great time gawking at all this. And then there was a dais, and a man came in all dressed in black, and he was to conduct operations. And there was a lovely window all along the side.
Sounds like a lovely relaxing room.
Yes. And then he sits up there and he says what he's introducing, and the introduction is that we want to wake up every morning feeling the day, approaching the day. We want to wake up facing every day with confidence. We want to be living our best
lovely
lives.
Sentiment.
And we need to make changes to be able to do this. So the inference was that we were all banjacks to begin with, that we were there, that we weren't full of confidence, we weren't living our best lives, and that we wanted to change. And we have to do this. This change, you'd be glad to know, you have to do it by looking into your minds during meditation. So you sit there during meditation, looking into your mind so that you can wake up in the morning full of confidence and be able to live your best life.
Works for millions of people across the
planet.
Indeed.
And so everybody was told to close the door. Now, it took him about 20 minutes to say all that, because you know the way you read American stuff and they tell you the thing and then they tell it to you again.
They speak slowly in a meditation.
Well, I mean, everybody speaks slowly except me. But anyway, there you go. So I was in Seattle. I was sitting there in the back with my gob shut for once. Can you imagine such a thing? And eventually we were all to close our eyes and we were to breathe in through our noses. So I was going to ask only, I was being good. I didn't say, if you have a cold and you can't breathe through your nose, yeah, you banjo, can you do this?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
No, nobody mentioned anything important like that. So they all sat there with their hands on their laps, all breathing through their noses with their eyes shut. Because I kept my eyes open to see what was happening. You see?
Yes.
And your man was there with his eyes shut. And he was busy walking us through this. We were to focus on the breath going through our nose. And I was there thinking, what'll I cook for the dinner? I have chicken at home in the fridge now. Well, I do it in a white sauce or whatever. Then I have to breathe through my nose.
Yeah, you're
again.
Doing it wrong, is it? You're supposed to.
And then,
I
looked out and there was a gorgeous robin that came down and was walking around pecking. I was looking at the robin breathing through my nose. And I thought, mother of God, will this ever be over? And after about, I suppose, 20 minutes, we opened our eyes and then we were to come back. And we were, by breathing, by looking into our mind, somehow we were meant to be able to. And it was nice and calm when we all sat down. And you had
did you get to look into your mind at any point?
For God's sake, sure. My mind is grand the way it is. I mean, I get up in the morning and I do what I want to do. And I mean, you only can live in the day you're in. You can only do what you're doing now. I'm in here talking to you, so there's no point in thinking what I did this morning. That's over. I got here in time. And I've no point in thinking what I'll do when I leave, because I haven't left yet.
You've mastered your mind already.
Yeah, but that's what every anybody behave like that? You can only live in the minute.
I have to do sketches for Callan's Kicks after this. I'm half writing them in my head here. And was that thing I did earlier on okay?
But if you went to meditation now, Jordan, whenever you have the eyes shut, you could be writing the script in your head. You could get peace. Because I was thinking, I was sitting there, now what will I say to Oliver when I go in now? Will I be? So I was busy writing out the script in my head. So I would recommend it. So if you want half an hour's peace to not have people ringing you up and stuff, you would.
What was your attitude towards the whole wellness and meditation world before you went in?
Well, I told you, I said an hour I won't get back. Sitting there thinking, giving yourself far too much notice.
So you preloaded yourself before going in, I'm not going to like this.
No, well, I think it's a waste of time to be sitting down thinking about yourself. If people stop thinking about themselves and go out and did something, they'd be better off. If I feel I need to get a bit of peace and quiet, go out for a walk, listen to the birds, go out to the woods, do that sort of thing. Not be sitting in the room thinking I'm breathing through my nose, out through my mouth. Oliver, I mean, there's only so many hours left in my life.
Never met such a cynical visiting critic.
It was a lovely experience. The people, they were all saying how wonderful it was afterwards, and I was supposed to be doing a vox pop and finding out how they all did. But the second person I went to said, I wanted to ask you about trees. And then the time when she'd finished asking me about the trees, everybody had gone home. But anyway.
Do you like that when people ask you random wildlife things?
Oh yeah, they're all usually they're civil and they say, you know, things like, I saw a spider the other day and I thought of you. And I think, oh, how interesting. What did you think? Because I had said in one of my books, you see, that spiders have all their legs on their heads. And people don't know that. I don't know where people think they have their legs, but they have all their legs on their heads. So the next time someone saw a spider, instead of leaping up in a chair and screaming, they actually looked at the spider.
You would
and
too.
Lo and behold, it had all its legs on its head. And now they're thinking, oh, yeah, Anna said that. And so like, you know, this
Do you
is
know, if
thing.
Your man had come in and started a session and said, I want everyone to breathe in and out and consider this fact, spiders have... Legs
all their legs
their
on their heads. All their legs.
That would clear all
legs.
Of the thoughts you had, wouldn't it?
Well, absolutely, indeed. And spiders or things like squirrels don't hibernate. In fact, they wrote a book about this called Wonders of the Wild.
You plug in your book already.
Yeah, well, of course I am. I brought it in because she didn't know spiders had legs on their head. I'm just actually looking for the page. Here they are. Look, there's the spider and there's its bottom and there's its top and there's all the legs coming out of its head.
Someone's already asking, can you get a potion? Can we buy this? Because they want your energy.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm lucky to be healthy, I suppose, and I should say that, you know, and it's not given to everybody to be full of beans, but I'm full of beans.
Has Aina ever done a show with Frances Brennan? That would be awesome, says Susan. That would be quite a competition, wouldn't it?
Poor Frances would have to get his,
you now.
He'd have to get his smelling salts after he was finished listening to me.
I'm the same as you. Couldn't be standing that meditation nonsense at all, yeah. Breathe in, breathe out. Get some Pledge. Breathe that in and Winderlene as well. Go on.
Well, anyway, you have done your time taking me off on things like skim.
Oh, yeah. Has that affected you? Or how do you feel like being made fun of? Not made fun of. I mean,
you're only up now.
Sorry,
you're only up to making fun of people.
No,
this is
never,
very interesting.
No.
Go now.
Like, what does she do? She's hypnotised me.
And another thing you did, you came on after one of the Mooney Goes Wild shows pretending to be Joe Duffy.
Going on
about flying bats and rats. And we all thought you were Joe Duffy because, you know, we weren't expecting our producers to do the dirt on us like this.
Yeah.
We got very cross.
Have a brilliant flow that lends itself to people, those of us who do the funny
voices. I'm very flattered. I mean, it's not everybody you take off. And the people you take off are obviously so well known that you don't have to explain who this person is. And usually you have me in the pole position taking the piss on Derek or something, which is all nice, you know. So you haven't done it in ages now. Come on. If you want something
We can solve that for sure. So taking off, I'm just thinking of you get going, you just take off all on your own. That is everything that you need. I can't even write a script for half the things you're going to do. Do you know, I'm even thinking about people coming up to you asking random wildlife questions. I was getting rid of ivy the other day off a tree. The ivy has destroyed all the trees in Ireland, but you're probably telling me, no, let the ivy alone. It's doing a lovely thing there now. It's looking after the birds and the bees and everything inside it.
Well, you don't need me here at all. Interview yourself. You ask the questions and then answer in my voice.
The redoubtable Aineen Ilana standing up to that Oliver Callan on his own show. Revenge, presumably, for the hour of her life that she'll never get back. And that's all I have for you on this Friday crack edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that'd be Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with a leaner, cleaner, meaner look back at an entire week in radio. Playback Daily is off for a few weeks for the Easter holidays, so from me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.